Aha, the whole story's a lie. The ship was commissioned too late. But they had other records that they smoked out. For example, I think it was submarine records of some encounters that were shared with other ships. All the records indicated that the ships were going the wrong direction after they were commissioned. And to make a long story short, they picked up such things as a hurricane hit in the Bermuda Triangle area. And the USS Eldridge was docked in Bermuda for a day or two, but the ship that reports it was a bit disturbed because the signal flags were not out and proper Navy procedure was not being followed as two ships meet and greet. And what they smoked out was the ship was built and not commissioned for 30 days later. And that with the necessity of ships, once they were commissioned, being assigned to various admirals, the minute they got them for war purposes, the chance of getting a ship for experiment was as remote as snowballs in hell. And what, in fact, they're able to smoke out and do it thoroughly and convincingly is that the ship, prior to commissioning, was, in fact, sent straight to Philadelphia and docked there. And for 30 days, they had the chance to do an experiment on this ship. And that's why it didn't show its signal flags, because en route to the dock in Philadelphia, the hurricane drove it into harbor at Bermuda for a few days, but it wasn't yet commissioned. So they proved conclusively the ship was in Philadelphia before it was commissioned. They also proved conclusively that it went out to sea and had contact with the Furuseth and was sailing in the right direction before the log dates are obliterated. Now that's one. They run down every lead. They confirm every confirmable part in terms of associated circumstantial evidence about the happening. There's a chapter in here that, for laymen, explains the unified field theory in a way that at least this preacher could understand. The possibility of isolating a gravitational field from electromagnetic field. The purposes that they were about in the experiment, which was to create this force field about 100 yards from each beam of the ship, which Allende said created a situation that if you were inside the field, the optical invisibility of the ship occurred, and the people in there were seen as hazy, and when they went into this field of invisibility, you had to feel around for them. And if you were outside the field, just against it, you could see the hazy figures within, though the ship was gone. You got further away, total invisibility took over. I could explain it abstractly, still didn't believe it. I mean, I could understand the explanation abstractly, but still couldn't believe it. But then we get down to their continued research to find corroboration. You ready for this? An unusual report was unexpectedly received by Patrick Macy, an electronic construction specialist and researcher, while he was working on contract in Los Angeles in the summer of 1977. It'd be interesting if some of these people are listening to me. He and another contract worker, Macy remembers him only as Jim, were discussing UFOs and how much they thought the government was covering up. Quote, "I had an unusual experience during World War II while I was in the Navy," said Jim. "Not with UFOs, but something pretty mysterious. I was a guard for classified audiovisual material. And in late 1945, I was in a position, while on duty in Washington, to see part of a film viewed by a lot of Navy brass pertaining to an experiment done at sea. I remember only part of the film, as my security duties did not permit me to sit and look at it like the others. I didn't know what was going on in the film, since it was without commentary. I do remember that it concerned three ships. When they rolled the film, it showed two other ships feeding some sort of energy into the central ship. I thought it was sound waves. But I didn't know, since I naturally wasn't in on the briefing. After a time, the central ship, a destroyer, disappeared slowly into a transparent fog until all that could be seen was an imprint of that ship in the water. Then, when the field, or whatever it was turned off, the ship reappeared slowly out of thin fog. Apparently that was the end of the film. And I overheard some of the men in the room discussing it. Some thought that the field had been left on too long and that that had caused the problems that some of the crew members were having. Somebody mentioned an incident where one of the crewmen apparently disappeared while drinking in a bar. Somebody else commented that the crew were still not in their right minds and may never be. There were also some references to some of the crew having vanished permanently. At that point, the conversation was carried on outside of my hearing. In the secure safety deposit box, there exists a photocopy of a newspaper clipping which was received from an anonymous source and which up to now has managed to survive all efforts to discredit its authenticity. Remember the reference by Carl of a newspaper article? Here it is. Strange circumstances surround tavern brawl. Several city police officers responding to a call to aid members of the Navy Shore Patrol and breaking up a tavern brawl near the U.S. Navy docks here last night got something of a surprise when they arrived on the scene to find the place empty of customers. According to a pair of very nervous waitresses, the Shore Patrol had arrived first and cleared the place out, but not before two of the sailors involved allegedly did a disappearing act. They just sort of vanished into thin air right there, reported one of the frightened hostesses. Or hostesses, and I ain't been drinking either. At that point, according to her account, the Shore Patrol proceeded to hustle everybody out of the place in short order. A subsequent chat with the local police precinct left no doubts as to the fact that some sort of general brawl had indeed occurred in the vicinity of the dockyards at about 11 o'clock last night. But neither confirmation nor denial of the stranger aspects of the story could be immediately obtained. One reported witness succinctly summed up the affair by dismissing it as nothing more than a lot of hooey from them Daffy Dames down there, who, he went on to say, were probably just looking for some free publicity. Damage to the tavern was estimated to be in the vicinity of $600. Victor Silverman. One unusually specific corroboration came from a seaman who claimed to have been on board during the dockside experiment at the Philadelphia Naval Yard and who since the incident has suffered a number of premature heart attacks. Victor Silverman is his name. Am I boring you? Now living in Pennsylvania. This is Sephora. But, you know, you're reading the book of Acts. Philip was on the Gaza Strip, and he was gone. And instantly, he's in Jerusalem. Oh, well, he went like a jet. Well, that's harder for me to believe than the other one. I mean, he was there, and then he was not there. And then he was somewhere else. Now, I've been telling you for quite some time. When it says in the Bible, Enoch walked and talked with God and was not, for God took him. Where? I believe God took him from Atlantis to the plains of Mesopotamia and the Nile River, and he built the pyramid with the help of watchers who could levitate stones. They've been trying to figure out for years how they got the stones from where they got them to the pyramid. If this is true, I know how they got them there. Now, if Einstein's brain could figure out the principle, oh, I know, if we don't understand it, it couldn't happen. You say, well, now, where'd the blood, where'd the bones, where'd the steel, where'd it go? What is all that stuff? When you reduce it down to physics. I mean, where'd all those people go when the atom bomb dropped at Hiroshima? They were there, and then they were not. What are we worried about blowing the world up? We're going to pull atoms apart and get a chain reaction. The China syndrome. Now, that's as strange to a Hottentot in Africa as this is to us. It sort of suggests the Bible might be right that the essential self is not transferred through blood transfusion. How do you think we're going to... Let's go on. Victor Silverman, now living in Pennsylvania and still mind... And I'm saying to you, if man through Einstein could figure out how to just dabble in this, don't you think demons know? They have the knowledge. They can levitate. Now, Christians for years have believed that demons and angels and some saints know how to conquer gravity. Oh, the angel of the Lord and the chariots thereof, the horsemen of the Lord and the chariots thereof. And Elijah goes up. Here comes the mantle. How'd that happen? You say a rocket. Horse spit. Elisha said it was a chariot and horses. You say, you mean God's that primitive? My Lord, if he'd have taken him in a space, if he'd taken him in a spaceship, it wouldn't even look miraculous to us today. The smarter we get and the more space travel we have, the more miraculous that chariot and horseman sailing off looks to me. I mean, there's real levitation. There ain't no horse in the world that can jump over the moon. Now, the most basic principle of biblical interpretation is your first meaning should be what it says. It's like these evangelicals saying those demons coming out of the pit led by Abaddon to bring hurt on the earth during the tribulation, the locust demons, or helicopters with flamethrowers attached. They're demons. Weird looking ones, too. Give you a heart attack to see them. I believe that Elijah was caught up in a chariot. Now think about that for a moment. Just think about it. Just think about it. Why don't you just think about it? Second Kings. First Kings. Second Kings. So many people read the Bible through, they don't pay attention to what it says. And it came to pass, 2 Kings 2:11, came to pass as they still went on and talked that, behold, there appeared, that's in italics, added by the translators, Let's just read it without the translator's help. It came to pass, as they still went on and talked, that behold, the chariot of fire and horses of fire. Parted them both asunder. I believe that's exactly what they were. Horses of fire and chariots of fire. If it was a spaceship, you'd say chariots. Horses of fire and chariots of fire. Parted them both asunder. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Storm clouds are literal translation. Now, we're leaving somebody, I guess. Don't know who, but I ain't stopping. I'm tired of being interrupted. Elijah takes off. Philip translated from Gaza Strip to Jerusalem. Now that power was available to Lucifer, to Christ, to the angels. I'm simply saying that if we are beginning to discover some of the principles of the universe until we can make them work in mysterious and strange ways. If this story is true, I don't have any trouble then with believing that demons know how to move doors and teleport them. I'm not going to give a scientific explanation to the source. I believe there are supernatural beings out there that know more about the workings of this universe than we do. I can't believe this story, but if I could believe this story, it'd make it easier to believe the other stories. And the other stories, if I can believe them, are less mystical and merely become a further extension of understanding on the way this universe is made up. By those that know it, we're just beginning to discover it. Now, what about Victor Silverman? Am I boring you? Victor Silverman, seaman, now living in Pennsylvania. Is that boring you? Victor Silverman, now living in Pennsylvania and still mindful of wartime security regulations and afraid of possible consequences, got in touch with the authors through a third party when he first heard about the publication of a book about the DE-173. He speaks from personal experience. Now, Carl saw it from afar. The guy with the movie saw some Navy brass years later looking at a movie about it. Victor Silverman says, I was on that ship at the time of the experiment. Let's listen to him. I mean, I'm from Missouri. At the outbreak of the war, Silverman enlisted in the Navy. He, along with about 40 others, were destined to become part of a special secret naval experiment. Well, now, if they rate ghost stories and lies and tall tales, this is the tallest and the biggest one, the worst lie of them all. You guys getting tired or something? I mean, they do that kind of camera work on CBS, NBC, and ABC, but never with us. Didn't I see a camera jerk down to find a book? Are you trying to duplicate the Philadelphia experiment? We just joined Reno and Los Angeles, and they don't know what I'm talking about. Now, the biggest lie that I have ever read is the Philadelphia experiment, William Moore and Charles Berlitz. I read it three times today. Still believe it's the biggest lie I ever heard, but I'm starting to believe it. I think I'm losing my mind. That's what they said. Everybody told this story. They certified them as loonies. Now, I haven't got time to catch up Reno and California, Los Angeles. I've already traced the way they set out disbelieving, but confirmed everything about it. And now they got Victor Silverman, now living in Pennsylvania and still mindful of wartime security regulations. I'm reading ghost stories, only this one ain't. I mean, I'm going right back to ghost stories in a minute. But this one brings us to the brink, based on Einstein's theory. Victor Silverman got in touch with the authors through a third party when he first heard about the publication of a book about the DE-173, the ship that supposedly disappeared. He speaks from personal experience. "I was on that ship at the time of the experiment," he says. At the outbreak of World War II, Silverman enlisted in the Navy. He, along with 40 others, was destined to become part of a special secret Navy experimental project involving a destroyer escort vessel and a process which he could identify only as degaussing. On board the vessel, Silverman noted that there was enough radar equipment on the ship to fill a battleship, including an extra mast, which was rigged out like a Christmas tree with what appeared to be antenna-like structures. At one point, am I hearing strange sounds in here? Did you hear it? Like something on the roof? You guys hear that?
Yes, sir.
You want to go check the roof? No? You want to go alone or you want somebody to go with you? Better take somebody with you. I don't think there's a ghost up there, but we have people that we have to look out for security reasons. I heard somebody up there. Did you or did you not? Was somebody pounding back here? Who's the guilty one? Go get Joe and bring him back. False alarm. Cut his legs off at the knee. At one point during the preparation for the experiment, Silverman remembers seeing a civilian on board and said to a shipmate, "That guy could use a haircut." To his amazement, he later discovered that the man had been Albert Einstein. Now, you've got to get the gestalt of this. I mean, these are coming from different sources, so many different places, but they all have little elements that represent what we call intrinsic indice of truth. This guy wouldn't know Einstein was there or involved. Silverman was given the rating of engineer first class, and according to his account, was one of three seamen who knew where the switches were that started the operation. He also related that a special series of electrical cables had been laid from a nearby powerhouse to the ship. When the order was given and the switches thrown, the resulting whine was almost unbearable. On another occasion, Silverman quite unexpectedly found himself in a deep fog, and his first thought was that he had somehow been blown off the ship. As he stood there, trying to comprehend what had happened, put yourself in the poor guy's place. He's walking on the ship, and then it ain't there. He thought he had been blown away. Get into this. I mean, you're sitting there as a skeptical. You can't even enjoy the poor fella that's having this happen to him. He's skeptical, too. That's what I said. On another occasion, Silverman quite unexpectedly found himself in a deep fog. And his first thought was that he had somehow been blown off the ship as he stood there trying to find the ship. As he stood there trying to comprehend what had happened and looking for looking for his ship. Looking for his ship. How'd you like Ernie? Put Ernie up there in the air. Now, just sort of get this feeling, Ernie. A green fog hits you, and you're just sitting there in the air trying to find your camera. Turn the lights out. That's fog. On another occasion, Silverman quite unexpectedly found himself in a deep fog. And his first thought was that he had somehow been blown off the ship as he stood there trying to comprehend what had happened and looking for his ship. He watched indistinct figures in motion whom he could not identify as sailors and some other shapes that didn't seem to belong on the dock, if that's where I was. Suddenly, the deep fog flashed off. Leaving Silverman in a very confused state and wondering what in the world I was doing in Norfolk. You understand? He started out in Philadelphia. He said he had recognized the place as Norfolk because I'd been there before the ships. I'd been there before to the ship's other dock there. Then just as suddenly, the green fog returned. It lifted again, and Silverman found himself back at dockside in the Philadelphia Navy Yard. Now, don't you imagine Philip sort of had that same feeling? I mean, he's down there talking to that Ethiopian eunuch, the edge of the desert. I don't know whether a fog hit him or not. But all of a sudden, he's surrounded by the smells of Jerusalem. For a long time afterwards, he related, I was left wondering whether or not I hadn't lost my mind for those few brief moments. I still don't know exactly what happened to me or to the other men who were there. Also very important is the fact that Silverman was able to recall the barroom brawl, which occurred shortly after this episode. He said, when the captain got word of this, he ordered everyone back aboard ship as fast as we could get there. We immediately put off from shore and stood out in the river all night until he got it straightened out. Tony Wells, now living in Southampton, England, writes about five British merchant seamen who in 1943 were waiting in Norfolk for berths on Liberty ships destined to go to England. One day, looking at the harbor from the dock, they were understandably amazed to see a sea level cloud suddenly form in the harbor and almost immediately dissipate, leaving a destroyer escort in full view, which stayed but a few minutes before it was covered by a cloud and vanished again. While the bemused seamen were wondering whether what they thought they had seen was real, the whole area was immediately cleared by naval security and shore patrol personnel.
This is the end of side three. For the rest of the teaching, please turn the tape over for side four. Thank you.